Buddha, the Dharma, to the Sangha. One of the frustrating things for me about talking about the precepts is that it's so hard to actually express what it is that's actually happening when you're training with the precepts. It's very frustrating for me when I look back and see, well, I talk about the precepts as if you were kind of had some kind of like conscious focus on the precepts a lot of the time. And that's actually not how it works. So I just want to say a few words about how, in my experience, it actually works. The way it's actually worked for me is that there's been certain key times in my training where I've really, in some way or other, needed to take the precepts at heart. Take the precepts to heart. And the way I view it is that there's the, you know, the precepts as they're kind of laid out. And then there's the preceptual truth, what Ramesh used to call preceptual truth. And preceptual truth is something deeper than any expression that we can give to it. And that preceptual truth is that which we turn towards when we turn away from that which is creating suffering and unhappiness. We naturally turn towards preceptual truth, especially after Sangha. You know, we just feel drawn to turn towards preceptual truth. Sometimes it happens right after Sangha. Sometimes there's a time lag before we kind of really consciously turn towards the precepts. In 1980, I did a retreat when I was down in the Bay Area with Reverend Master, and it started. I was in the meditation hall doing my normal morning meditation, and it just all of a sudden, it's like, I wouldn't say I exactly heard a voice, but it was like a voice. It said, basically, go to Reverend Master. Go to Reverend Master. Well, Reverend Master was still asleep. So I went in and I woke her up. And I said, I was in the meditation hall and I just heard or felt, come to you, come see you. And Reverend Master just said, well, what is it you need to do? And it just kind of came out of my mouth, you know. Well, I just feel I need to meditate and study the precepts. So Rim Master just rearranged everything from that moment so that I could go into retreat. And I went into retreat and I really kind of popped. And I look back on it, it was actually I'd done a Sangha over a period of some period of time in the previous winter. I had done a Sangha. It lasted, I don't remember how long it lasted, but several days at least. It went on for a while. I'd been really scared and doing some dumb things, and it's kind of like in the winter things went quiet and I had a chance to really sit still a bit and really realize and really see and really do a Sangha. And so, you know, a number of months went by and then this happened. It was actually a year and a half before. So sometimes there's a time lag, but at any rate, there are times in our life when the heart naturally turns towards the precepts, just instinctively. You know, we need to turn towards preceptual truth. We need to see the way we need to walk. And the way we need to walk is always a preceptual path. And then we take the precepts to heart just by saying, I wish to follow the preceptual path. I wish to take the precepts to heart. we take them to heart. And then it's like, and here's the thing I really want to say here about how the precepts really work. It's like we've said yes to the path to the eternal. So the eternal says, right, you want to walk the preceptual path? Now I can use the precepts to help you. And this is what I've been stumbling around trying to say since I started talking about the precepts here and not been able to say it. And I'd say it's frustrating me because I can't find myself skirting around it. But of course, now I say it, it seems obvious, you know. You know, just like everything else in the spiritual life, you got to get out of the driver's seat and hand it to the Eternal. Then the Eternal can use it to help you. So, from that point of view, what are the precepts but this amazing gift from the Eternal showing the path of following the Eternal? So, how does the Eternal use it? Well, in my experience, you know, one doesn't sit down and kind of intellectually constantly try to figure out the precepts. One lives one's daily life having taken the precepts to heart, having said, I wish to follow the precepts, please help me. And then what happens when we start to wobble on one of the precepts, the Eternal lights that precept for us. So we start to get angry, the precept, do not indulge anger, comes up. We start to get swept away in sexual longing, and the precept, do not covet, do not indulge sexuality, comes up. We start to think badly and speak badly of others, and the precept, do not speak against others, lights up. And so the precepts are kind of like in there, in the basket. And when we need, because we have said yes to the path of the precepts, because we've taken the precepts to heart, now the Eternal can use them to help us. And it's the Eternal using them to help us more than our kind of determination to follow them. It's both, of course. And the greater part is always the part that the Eternal does. And the lesser part is always the part that we do. So that's what I've been... something I've been trying to say, but I couldn't say it until I could say it, I guess. After yesterday's talk, I felt a little frustrated because I had this sense in when I was talking yesterday that somehow I just kept missing something. And it's later on in talking with someone that it hit me what I was missing. Master says about the 10 precepts, she says, above all, the precepts do not kill and do not steal seem to stand out, as did the first three precepts, the three pure precepts, cease from evil, do good for others. Those ones particularly seem to stand out as especially important. Then comes the day of what is Buddha, what is Dharma, and what is Sangha. Dogen says, in the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, there are three merits. The first is the true source of the three treasures. And Reverend Master says, there is an unborn, uncreated, unformed, undying, indestructible, the Lord of the house. That which speaks in stillness, silence and in stillness, the still small voice. Dogen says, the second merit is the presence in the past of Shakyamuni Buddha. Reverend Master says, all those who have truly transmitted Buddhism throughout eternity. Then Dogen says, the third is his presence at the present time. Reverend Master says, all those who transmit the truth, who live by the precepts and make them their blood and bones, the Sangha, the embodiment of the preceptual truth of the Buddhas. I'm not quite sure in terms of... there's some kind of doctrinal basis to what Dogen is saying here. In the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, there are three merits. I'm not exactly sure what that is. One thing that's occurred to me is it might be what's called the Trikaya, meaning the three bodies, the Mahayana's doctrine, the three bodies of the Buddha. The Dharmakaya, which is the Buddha nature, the eternal. The Sambhogakaya, or Sambhogakaya in a minute. The Nirmanakaya, which is the historical Buddha, or the body of Buddha manifesting in human form. And then the Sambhogakaya, which means the reward body, often translated as the reward body or fulfillment body or enjoyment body, merit body, which is, as I understand, is really just the experience of enlightenment. These are called the three bodies of the Buddha in Mahayana doctrine. The Dharma body, the body of truth, the eternal true reality. The Nirmanakaya, which means the appearance body, the body in which the Buddha appears to help beings, all the Buddhas and ancestors. The Sambhogakaya, the reward body, the body in which the actual experience of enlightenment and of any aspect of enlightenment. So that might be what these three merits refers to. The first is the true source of the three treasures. That's the Dharmakaya, the eternal. The second is the present, the passive, the Shakyamuni Buddha. That'd be the Nirmanakaya. The third is his presence at the present time. Well, you could, as she says here, it's anyone who transmits the truth, who lives by the precepts. But what is that but the manifestation of enlightenment? Sambhogakaya. So that could be what it's referring to. I'm not completely sure of that, but I just thought I'd throw that in there. I mean, what harm can it do? Rim Master goes on to say, Dogen says next, the highest truth is called the Buddha treasure. Rim Master says, the knowledge of that which is, the knowledge of the unformed, uncreated, unborn, undying, indestructible, the certainty without doubt of its existence, the knowledge of it within oneself, the Buddha living within oneself, the Lord of the house who directs all things. If I study true Buddhism, what Buddhism truly is, I will become as the water wherein the dragon dwells, as the still water wherein dwells the Lord of the house. It is necessary to know the true dragon. It is necessary to ask the dragon, the Lord of the house, at all times to help and to teach. You see, again and again, coming back to the asking. The getting out of the driver's seat, the bowing, the asking. Only if I give all that is required of the price that the dragon asks, will he show me the jewel. Offer everything. Ask sincerely, offer wholeheartedly. That's the offering. I must accept the jewel from the dragon without doubting its value or querying the price. Well, you could lecture on what I've just read, this one paragraph I've just read till eternity, which, fortunate for you, I'm not going to do. But, this is, in a way, almost anything I say would be watering it down or saying making less of it than it is. It's so magnificently expressed. I just encourage everyone here and everyone who listens to these talks to read Reverend Master's commentary on the precepts again and again and get this into your blood and bones. I'm afraid I'm not going to say anything about what I've just read other than this. It's just too perfect. This is too perfect. Immaculacy is called the Dharma treasure. One must live with the roots of karma cut away. To do this, I must indeed know the house builder of this house of ego, know all his tools, know all his building materials. There is no other way that I can know immaculacy. The house builder of the house of ego must be known absolutely, recognized at all times. It is not enough to have a kensho. I must go back to the source of the karmic stream. I must return to that source to find out what set it going. Kensho shows that the slate is clean. To find the source of karma cuts its roots, and with constant training keeps evil karma at a minimum. But since there is nothing from the first, there is nothing clean and nothing that is unclean. I cannot know this, however, until I have first tried to clean it. Most houses can do with a thorough sweeping, but even a million sweepings will not clear away the dust completely. That's a quote there. Thus I remain in my body and accept it, knowing that nothing matters, that I am immaculate, always was and always will be. This is the immaculacy of the Dharma treasure. This makes the immaculacy and harmony of the Sangha treasure possible. It is the knowledge of the true Kesa, that which is immaculate above all dust and dirt, the knowledge that the dust and dirt are indeed a figment of my own ego's imagination as a result of past accrued karma, that makes possible the transmission of the light from the far past to the now and the far future without words. The scriptures show up blank pages. There is a transmission that lies beyond them. There's two parts to this paragraph that I've read. In the first of them, Rim Master talks about knowing the house builder of the house of ego. The house builder here really just stands for the ways in which we habitually create suffering, for the kind of combined causes of suffering within ourselves. And so she's emphasizing in the first part of this paragraph that we have to study ourselves and find out how we create suffering. And we have to find the sources of suffering within ourselves, the causes of suffering, and come to recognize them. The process of this finding one's way back to the causes of suffering, which in the end are always, you know, very particular events from the past, and not just this past life, this life, but also the, you know, especially the lives, the past life inheritance, because the real roots of suffering lies in those lives, our past life inheritance. It's those karmic tangles that brought us into existence. When someone else died, there was a spiritual need remaining that resulted in our being born. That need getting passed on, as it were, reborn in another person so that it could, you know, find its way to the eternal. If we do not clean up the karma in our lifetime, then at the time of our death, you know, it will get passed on. The need will get passed on to someone else. So it's the greatest compassion one can do, in the true sense, is simply to clean up one's karma so it a mess doesn't get less for some other poor devil to pick up and have to deal with. When Dogen was transmitted, he asked some questions of his master. And I won't say what those questions were, but his master basically said to him, you know, that's fine, but study in detail. Do not think it is easy. And River Master's remarks here about the house builder, the house of ego, and how essential it is, no matter how far one's gone in training, how essential it is to keep working on oneself. Remember that the focus of our training in terms of our practical daily life is always got this fundamental aspect of working on ourselves, working on self. It's like that remark of Dogen's master, Nyojo Zenji. It's like his remark. Study in detail. Do not think it is easy. Don't think that just in one or two experiences that you're going to clean up the karma. Don't think that just by remembering the past you're going to clean up the karma. You got to take that habit energy from the past. You got to train with it, and it's got to change its course. And there is no shortcut to it. There's no easy way to do it. When all conditions ripen, and when 99% of a particular karmic jangle has been a particular jangle of doubt and confusion and pain, when 99% of it's been converted through just normal daily training, normal daily meditation, following the precepts, training oneself, when 99% of it's been dealt with, converted, then the root of karma can show itself. And when the root of karma shows itself, then there is the actual experience of the enlightening of that particular jangle of karma. When it actually experiences it, going all the way back to the eternal and dissolving into the immaculacy of nothingness. And later in this lotus blossom, we'll see how that happens. It's the process is described in detail as much as you can describe it. But remember, there's got to be that previous 99% of work has to be done. Now, don't make the mistake of thinking that any single experience is going to clean up all the karma. It just doesn't work that way. There's no substitute for day in and day out committed training. No substitute for it. There ain't no magic wand. And we are very fortunate we do experience at the moment of that where the karma hits the bell fully, so to speak, it's pure grace. In Christianity, I suppose you could say in Buddhism too, Yeah, it's true in Buddhism too. There are the schools of Buddhism that emphasize the grace side of things and schools that emphasize the work side of things. And the same is true in Christianity. Faith and works is a famous kind of division in Christianity. Some Christian sects emphasizing salvation through faith, others through salvation through works. In actual fact, for real karmic conversion to happen, you have to have both faith and works, grace and works. You gotta do your trucking. No one's going to do it for you. And the help of the eternal is always there, whether we recognize it or not. And there is, from time to time, the experience of pure grace, where we know that the eternal did it entirely, and we were just at that moment, most fortunate person in the world who was the spectator. spectator to our own little piece of enlightenment happening. And then we got to go on. And there's always more to do. So we come to the point where at one and the same time we know, as Rev Master says, that nothing matters, that I am immaculate, always was and always will be. And this is the immaculacy of the Dharma treasure. This immaculacy the inherent immaculate emptiness of all existence is the Dharma treasure. And that does not stand against the fact that there's something to clean up. The something to clean up, including all of its pain and confusion, and sometimes the immense grief that's encapsulated within it, and the cleaning process, they're all contained within the immaculacy. There is nothing from the first. And we need to clean up our karma. And we need the Eternal's help doing it. When we look with unenlightened eyes, we see dust and dirt everywhere. Rav Massey used to say, don't see evil where evil does not exist. There's a story of the sixth patriarch. I don't remember the question that was asked him, but the sixth patriarch's answer was, I don't see the faults of others, I only see my own faults. You know, it's so important that even when we are seeing with unenlightened eyes, that we remember, that we listen to that part of us that is not unenlightened, that we remember that there is nothing from the first. The truth is the immaculacy. The surface appearance temporarily, when we're looking with unenlightened eyes, is the dirt. It's so important to, in our training, to work at seeing the good in others and believing in and seeing the good in ourselves as well. If you look with the eyes of a Buddha, you will see the heart of a Buddha. If you look with unenlightened eyes, you will see just dirt and dust wherever you work. Wherever you look, you'll see. One will see one's own unfulfilled expectations, one's own judgment of oneself, everywhere one looks. Often people think of the Dharma as being being what people teach, you know, like I'm sitting here doing a Dharma talk. But if you really look at what's being said here in this talk about the Dharma treasure, you'll see you can't teach what the Dharma really is, because the Dharma treasure is just what you really are, what the world really is. You know, never think that any of us creates the Dharma, or that the Buddha created the Dharma. You know, it is. When we train ourselves, we open our hearts and our minds to it. When Reverend Master says, the scriptures show up blank pages, there is a transmission that lies beyond them. She's not in any way being disrespectful to the scriptures. I'm sure we all know that. But she isn't. Remember earlier in this retreat, she said, the scriptures must be taken literally, for they were written and formulated at death's door. The truths were discovered at death's door. And again, there is no scripture that is what the Dharma really is. What the Dharma really is. The Dharma is the immaculacy of nothingness. Dogen says, next, harmony is the Sangha treasure. The Rib Master says, this is brought about by the knowledge that no matter what I, a member of the Sangha, may do, I am immaculate from the very beginning. There is nothing from the first. Thus shall you think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a child's laugh, a phantasm, a dream. She quoted that before, didn't she? It's from the Diamond Sutra. A wonderful expression of the flow of immaculacy, which is what Uji really is about. Remember the chapter on being time, existence, time, in Dogen Uji. It's that flow of immaculacy. That's what it's about. She says, although this is true, I, the members of the Sangha, the Zen masters, all beings are bound by the law of karma. We will pay the price of what we do. Thus is the mind of the Sangha treasure. In other words, it's not just enough that I and other members of the Sangha know that, believe that there is this immaculacy that is the truth of all existence. You know, we actually have to act in accordance with that. And you can't do that if you defy the law of karma. Because then the knowledge of immaculacy, the true understanding of immaculacy, just becomes another form of ideology. And even while one professes the belief in immaculacy, if one is acting non-perceptually, one is simply turning the knowledge of immaculacy into a delusion, no longer the true knowledge. Just an opinion, another opinion. In order to live in accordance with, in harmony with the truth, we must walk the path of the precepts. I've said this before, but I want to say it again, that I always think of the harmony of the Sangha treasure as being like harmony in music, musical harmony. And if you want to have harmony in music, if you're like a composer and you're writing music and you want to actually write music which expresses beautiful harmony, well, you have to compose according to the rules of writing harmony, or the principles of writing harmony. And if you simply defy these principles, the music will not be pleasant to the ear. It will be painful. There's a lot of modern, kind of more avant-garde-ish kind of composing that deliberately does that for some reason I've never quite understood. Deliberately frustrates and irritates people because the composers who should know better, are deliberately writing in such a way as to jangle people's nerves and irritate their nerves. Some people may find that beautiful. I think that they tend to be people who are really stuck in their heads, frankly. I just find it enormously frustrating and want to clout the composer on the side of the head. Rib Master said that when she studied harmony, Rib Master, of course, was a very fine musician and a very, very fine composer. She said that they taught her the principles of harmony as actually ethical principles. She said that she was actually taught an ethic that you did not leave your audience frustrated at the end of your composition. You actually had an obligation, a moral obligation as a composer, not to write your music in such a way that it actually jangled people's nerves. It's very interesting. So Well, this is true of the Sangha treasure as well. That if we are truly living and acting as a Sangha treasure, we cannot do those things which willfully create disharmony. We cannot do those things that cause other members of the Sangha to suffer needlessly. And to not do those things, we must follow the path of the precepts. We must walk a preceptual path. We must take the precepts to heart. Because however much we may love one another as fellow members of the Sangha, and there is no human love stronger than the love that Sangha members have for one another. However much we may love one another, if we do not stick to the same preceptual path, our love will not prevent us from hurting one another any more than it does any people in the world. Families love one another, of course. They do. You can't. No matter what miseries you've suffered at the hands of your families, you can't help but love them still. And, you know, it's a famous statistic that the majority of violent crime happens within the home. Family members taking it out on each other, you know. So if we want to know the harmony of the Sangha, we have to not take it out on each other, but instead treat each other with respect. And not lead each other into delusion. And when we do so, which, of course, being human beings, we, as Sangha members, we make all the mistakes other human beings make in one way or another. You know, when we find that we've led each other into confusion, that we've hurt one another, well, apologize and do Sangha and set it right. Do what we can to set it right. And then go on. My experience is that there's no people in the world who are better at forgiving one another, accepting one another, than the Sangha treasure is. And I have benefited from this personally again and again over the years, that people have been so accepting and so forgiving of my own humanity. And it's a constant reminder to me to remember to be, try to be as accepting of others' humanity as they, others, you know, have been of mine. There's another thing about harmony in music that is a, helps understand the harmony of the Sangha. Imagine an orchestra getting ready for a concert. And suppose they're going to play a piece, say, by Beethoven or Mozart or someone, you know. You know the music's beautiful. You know the music's beautiful. They got good material to work with, so that's not in question. They're not playing something by a composer who's got a screw loose. They're playing something by a composer who could really write music and wrote beautiful music. So they're getting ready for their concert. Suppose they've got a good conductor. Just before they're going to play, the first violin gives them concert A to all tune their instruments to. Suppose that they all just said, the hell with concert A. I've had it. We do this every day, you know. Today I'm going to tune to something else. They all just go bonkers and all tune to another note. Now they sit down and play the piece. It's chaos. It's total chaos. No matter how good the composition is, no matter how good the conductor is, no matter how good the orchestra is, if they're not all attuned to the same concert A, the same pitch, their instruments won't be in tune with one another, and it's going to sound awful. poor old Beethoven or Mozart are spinning in their graves at this point. So, for me, this metaphor means that if we're really going to act as the Sangha treasure, we've got to tune ourselves into the right pitch. And that pitch is the voice of the eternal. We have to be listening with our hearts to the eternal to function truly as the Sangha and for the true magnificent harmony of the Sangha to manifest fully. As members of the Sangha, we need to be listening to the eternal and following the eternal. When we're training with a master, we need to be listening to the master's teaching and following the master's teaching. And the master's teaching had better be following the eternal, or the master will lead us all into chaos. In something that Rev. Master Mokshin wrote, she really emphasized this point in a wonderful way, that for each of us as a member of the Sangha, our fundamental responsibility is the responsibility to, I think I can quote it exactly, to ask, to listen, and to follow where our true heart leads. And that really, that is our responsibility, each of us individually. When we do that, we are the Sangha treasure. When we do that together, we are a Sangha. If we totally cease to do that, you know, how can we really function as a Sangha? What was the original Sangha, Buddha Sangha? It's those people who came to Shakyamuni Buddha to follow him after his enlightenment. That was the first Sangha. The first Sangha was those 5 ascetics who abandoned him when he sat down to do his meditation. You could really say the first Sangha was the Buddha when he was enlightened. And then, immediately afterwards, then people started to recognize that this is someone who really found the truth and wanted to follow his teaching and his example. And there you had the birth of the Sangha. But what were they? They were followers of the true path, followers of the path to enlightenment, the path of enlightenment. So what is the Sangha today, 2,500 years later? How can it be anything but that? And how can that Sangha know harmony if its members do not do what all Sanghas must do? This is the Buddha, this is the Dharma, this is the Sangha.